For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Okay, thank you and good evening. And I'm very happy to have speaking tonight Sunil Yadev, who's our intern from the University of Chicago Divinity School, and he's going to speak tonight about his experiences and research. Was it in December that you went to Burma?
Last summer.
Oh, last summer. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so just by way of introduction, so very happy to have Sunil here helping us out. And Burma is a situation that... Well, the Chicago Buddhist Peace Fellowship has paid a lot of attention to, and a very complicated situation. But what's happening now, and not to, and you may have many other things to talk about. But we like to think of Buddhism as peaceful and tolerant, and yet in Burma there's a situation where the Burmese Buddhists have been really. Persecuting the Muslim minority. So it's a very difficult situation. And anyway, thank you very much for Sunil for coming and tonight and speaking to us. So please take it.
Thank you. So like Taigen mentioned, thank you for having me today. And I would like to thank Laurel and Neojan as well for guiding me through this whole process. And thank you everybody for being here today. And this is a great opportunity, and I'm really grateful for it. So, like Taigen said, this is not necessarily going to be like a great world Dharma talk in many ways. It's more of a reflection in some ways of my summer trip to Myanmar, where I was primarily looking at what kind of interfaith work is going on in terms of mitigating the conflict from both Buddhist and Muslim sides. But this, right away when I went there, I realized that this issue is a lot more complicated than just Buddhists persecuting Muslims or minority Muslims in itself. So I'll briefly reflect on a couple of things. One, the powerful influence of spirituality or religion in itself in our society, both constructive and destructive. Another thing I would like to focus on is that perception of Buddhism in the West and how those two relate, how what's happening in Myanmar relates with our perception of Buddhism here. Oftentimes we used to think Buddhism is something that's fairly peaceful, fairly, in some ways, nice religion, or nice practice, but it's not necessarily always the case. In the past, before Myanmar, there have been Tamils in Sri Lanka who's been persecuted by Theravada Buddhists. In Thailand, there have been more monks who's taken up arms against the minority indigenous people. So it has happened in the past. But this situation is a little bit different in many ways as well. So before I jump into the actual thing of the conflict itself, I want to give you a little bit of background of where it all starts for me and for the conflict itself. I started paying attention when... this thing came out, the picture is not that great, but this thing came out in Time magazine. He's the main monk, one of the main monks in Myanmar's religious sphere. So this thing came out in Time magazine, and I started thinking, like, what does this mean for us as a Buddhist practitioner anywhere in the world
in
itself?
What year was that?
Sorry?
What year was that?
This was, I think, 2012. Yeah. 2012, when it first came out.
And if you couldn't see, the lettering says "The Face of Buddhist Terror,"
yep.
And a picture of one of the leading Buddhists is taking that position.
Yeah. Yep. His name is Wiraku. So I kind of thought, this would be a neat thing to do. So I applied for a grant and then went to Myanmar for 2.5 months. So primarily when I'm talking about Buddhists in Myanmar, I'm talking about Theravada monks. And when I'm talking about Muslims, it's mostly Rohingya Muslims and Bengali and Indian immigrant Muslims who are living within Myanmar. Myanmar ethnically is a very complicated state. There are more than 25 different ethnic communities. Within those communities, Burmese, which is always composes the largest number of ethnic community, is the largest. Muslims are 4%, where Burmese are 68%, and those comprises the most of Theravada monks there. So to go back a little bit to the history of Myanmar, I think it gives some context on why the way the conflict is there right now. Myanmar, as we all know, it was under military rule from 1962 until 2012. We've heard of Saffron Revolution that was all over the Western media, and it's been a country that's been ruled by different dictatorship military rulers for a while. And it was not until 2012 that it kind of got this democratic state, but it's still quasi-democratic in a sense that still the military rulers are in the government. So it's democratic, but not quite yet. During those tumultuous time, Buddhism was a great part of Myanmar. While military rulers were putting in communist and socialist ideas into Myanmar society, what united Burma as a country was Buddhism and monkhood. Monks were the biggest source of support for lay people. There was a lot of suffering, a lot of pain, no democratic process at all. So at that time, the only source of getting out of that suffering was spirituality of Buddhism, what Buddhism offered. So it had a lot of constructive power in Myanmar society, like we saw in Saffron Revolution. It kind of brought the democracy into the country. Regarding Buddhism, and we have also heard about Aung San Suu Kyi, who is one of the world's forefront of democratic process and work. She says the countries that embraced Buddhism did so because they needed it, because there was something violent in their society that needed to be controlled by Buddhism. So Buddhism is seen as something that's so powerful in terms of providing people with peaceful support, a source of good spirituality. And it worked in Myanmar for many, many years, since 1962 till 2012. It was always this powerful presence. But then a little bit after 2012, after the so-called democratic country became established in Myanmar, the active persecution of Rohingyas started. By active persecution, the mosques were burned, lots of shops were burned, people were literally stabbed to death and killed, and all that happened very quickly, very rapidly. Situation disintegrated really fast. And the main accusation is that Muslims are not from Myanmar. But to look at a little bit of history, they've been there since 7th century AD in Myanmar, and they have lived there. They came for trade as from Persia and all that. They've been there for a while. They've just been a minority and in the lower level of ethnic so-called food chain of sort. So why are Muslims in some ways targeted like this? I mean, there's so many other ethnic communities, but why are specifically Muslims targeted? There are multiple reasons that, as I found out throughout my, I interviewed about 25 people and attended around 12 events during 2 months period. And there are different social, political, economic, and other religious reasons. But I'll go a little bit more into theological and religious reasons and how they are doing, how these monks are doing this, inciting this violence. So like I said before, Myanmar became a quasi-democratic country in 2012, which meant a lot of ethnic communities came up, meaning claiming their political rights, social rights, religious rights in Myanmar society. So the voices started coming up. This kind of threatened with this monkhood order, in a sense that they've been so central to Myanmar's identity in many ways. This in some ways was seen as a threatening gesture by Buddhist fundamentalist monks who had this fundamental sentiment. So they started using the capital they had built over this tumultuous time of military dictatorship to influence the politics, the social changes, and everything, including the violence. So they started being violent towards Muslim in that sense that these are the people we don't want in our country. These are coming up. They're going to be integrated into our society. We don't want that because this is, in some ways, this is Buddhist nation. This is our country. And they are outsiders. So how is it that they're being able to convince people, these lay practicing, very, very highly involved, disciplined practitioners of Buddhism, go out in the street and incite violence? How are they able to convince to do that? So this guy who I saw earlier, he has a big monk school, and he does preaching. One of the things that you hear every day in Myanmar is in the morning there's loud speakers and you hear lot of talks, Dharma talks in some ways. There's a lot of recitations of different suttas and different mantras that goes to everybody's household, TV, radio, public speakers and all that. I would wake up every morning, 5 a.m, with those loud speakers. So one of the suttas they use is Mangala Sutta. It is a Pali canon, which is also in English you can translate as the discourse of on the highest blessing. So it's seen as a proven truth of some sort. So this text, Mangala Sutta, this Pali canon, is the first text a child learns in Myanmar. It's almost like initiation ritual text. Every child in Myanmar, every Buddhist child in Myanmar learns this text. And this is also the text that Urartu and his compatriots, his school of fundamental Buddhism go to most of the time to interpret this. This is what the text that's been cited a lot of times. With fools no company keeping, with the wise ever consorting, to the worthy home is paying, this the highest blessing. So with fools no company keeping, that's the very, very crucial line there. By fools, a lot of times, Urartu is interpreting as Muslims. Muslims are the fools. And Urartu goes as far as calling those fools, replacing that fool's term in Pali with dogs. So it's like, with dogs, no company keeping, referring to Muslims. So one can see how this text could be so crucial in terms of swaying public opinions or planting this in public's head. In a sense, every child learns this text. And when you interpret the text like this, it's very very handy in terms of citing violence and outrage in a society. The another text that is frequently used is Kala Chakra text, which is not even a Theravadan text in many ways. It's a Tibetan text predominantly. And this is where the whole movement started. This is the text that was used in the beginning. The text says, the Chakravartin shall come out at the end of the age. From the city, the gods fastened on Mount Kailasa. He shall smite the barbarians in battle with his own 4-division army on the entire surface of earth. This is kind of like apocalyptic text, Buddhist text, and it describes the barbarians coming in and then somebody coming out, Chakravartin coming out of Mount Kailasa and destroying all the barbarians because they are corrupt. They corrupt our society, they corrupt the Buddhist society, so-called Buddhist society. And the barbarians in is interpreted as Muslims. Muslims are the ones who are the barbarians. And this can be seen in public works, like newspapers, pamphlets, and like I said, the early morning recitations. So this is happening, and so when I was there a week later in Mandalay, similar thing happened. There was a case of somebody being raped. A Buddhist woman was raped 2 years ago, but the temple, the monk came out and said, okay, a Muslim man raped a Buddhist woman, we gotta do something about it. So people came out on the streets, went burning businesses, two Muslims were killed. One Buddhist, two Muslims were killed in the conflict. So a lot of times the violence just happens because these religious leaders are going out there and in some ways directly contributing to in its incitation, like directly inciting this violence because they're saying, oh, these are Muslims men who are doing bad things to Buddhist women. it turned out that in that specific incident that happened in Mandalay, the rape did not occur. The man who was occurred right then, it was 2 years ago, the man who allegedly raped the woman was Buddhist himself, and he was not even Muslim. So it's just, they're just using anything they can in some ways. Their religious spiritual capital they have built over the years in the society to incite violence in many ways. So what does this mean for us? Like, how does this relate to us practicing Buddhism here, any kind of Buddhism, or any kind of spirituality in itself? So when I was giving this similar talk at Rockefeller, one thing I mentioned was we oftentimes tend to, like I mentioned in the beginning, tend to romanticize Buddhism in the West. Romanticizing Buddhism is a very common thing. Buddhism is not all perfect, I think. In that sense, I think we got to stop romanticizing Buddhism and take it for what it's worth. In many ways, asking questions about what Buddhism is or what our practice is. And I'm not talking about asking questions in a sense, like Suzuki Roshi says, if you keep asking questions, it's like stacking horses on top of a horse and trying to ride the horse. I'm not saying like ask questions like that, but being mindful of what's going on around and asking questions about those things, like what's happening in Myanmar, how does that affect your practice? How does that affect my practice? How does that affect us being here, sitting in the cushion and meditating? How does that relate? Or does that relate at all? That's for yourself to explore, but I think beginning to ask these questions, how does Buddhism globally impact our own practice as well? I think those are the crucial questions. In some ways, it impacted my own quest or my own inquiry, in the sense, like, what does this incident mean for me as a practicing Buddhist, as a student of Buddhism? That's why I went to Myanmar. And another thing is, if we have some idea of what we practice, and to our practice, like a philosopher, is as good as its doubters are, like people who doubt philosophy, he's as good as how many doubters he has. So is one sort of his way of notion of idea of practice and spirituality. I'm not saying you doubt it, but you try to pay mind to it, be aware of it. Don't just do it, but be aware of what you're doing. Another thing is to understand that religion can be both constructive and destructive. And going back again to romanticizing idea that we should be aware of that religion has the potential to be both constructive and destructive, like we saw in the case of Myanmar. And also, we all have that capital that Theravada and Buddhist in Myanmar have in our practice, in our spirituality. We all have this capital. It's up to us how we use that in here and outside in this world, how we can utilize in a productive and constructive way. And to do that is, I think, a very compassionate act in a sense, like to use the spirituality in building relationships with others is a very compassionate act in that sense. So I hope my ramblings in some ways give some perspective or some relationship to your practice, you being here, and in general how things are in Myanmar and how does that relate to Buddhism. I will be very much, this is very small part of the larger project that I'm working on. And I'll be very happy to talk about political, economic, and other social agendas that's in play in Myanmar, definitely. And I hope in some ways it contributes to your thinking of your practice and your spirituality. I would welcome any comments, questions, concerns to that.
Thank you very much, Sunil. And I hope we have some discussion, but I want to just make a few comments. It's a really important topic, the way that religion can be used and misused, and as you were saying, fundamentalist versions of religion. So it's very alive in lots of ways in our world now, obviously. And I have to confess that I'm tempted to point out that you're talking about Theravada Buddhists, who are you know, the phrase that you were talking about stay away from fools or whatever, however this worded, is a kind of context that in the Theravada tradition, which is focuses on individual practice and perfecting the self, is a little different from our bodhisattva idea, where we, you know, try to be inclusive and acknowledge all beings and not be focused on perfecting the self exclusively. That said, though, of course, historically in our you know, memory, there have been abuses of Buddhism also in Japan and China historically. Zen in war, the part that some Zen teachers played in supporting the kind of jingoism that was before World War II in Japan. So it's a very complicated issue. So just to acknowledge that, and then the other thing is just, you know, it seems very poignant that you're talking about this week, the events in France, mm-hmm. and the horrible attack against that newspaper, violent attack, but also, you know, the divisiveness that's in the world now and the way in which our mass media, and I think Douglas and I were talking before, and he was saying if he was a Muslim in Islamic in France now, he'd be terrified. And I think that part of how our mass media is reacting too is to support this idea of Muslims as others. And so there's so many issues that come up from what you're talking about in our society, the way minorities are persecuted and the injustice against African Americans, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge topic, and how we use religious teachings and also how we see the possibility of their misuse. So thank you for raising that. I just wanted to say those things. But comments, questions, responses for Sunil. Yes, Bill.
Thank you for the talk. So I wondered about the political and economic basis of at least monastic Buddhism in Myanmar. Is it state supported? Is it state sanctioned? Is it economically supported through taxation and that sort of thing? And I wondered if that had anything to do with some of these conflicts in terms of economic competition.
Thank you for the question. Absolutely. There's the whole thing is like taken. It's very complicated in the sense like everything is so intertwined with each other. Politically, a little bit speaking, there is no direct support. Buddhism has never become state religion in Myanmar. However, monks are probably one of the most venerated social figures. Political leaders go to the monks for advice all the time and wisdom for all the time. So in that sense, they have a lot of political capital within the country, although it's not constitutionally recognized. In terms of economics, again, there's large part of Buddhism in Myanmar is dana in a sense, and there's a lot of monks. There's such a large number of monks. They highly depend on the economy of dana in a sense, the charity, and government is a big part in that. And another aspect of Muslim being target is that historically Muslims are traders. They traded jade and ruby and all the stones. So they are some of the families in Myanmar are one of the richest family in the whole country. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, they are economically targeted as well. And another thing is, recently a mobile company came to Myanmar called Redu from Dubai, and there's a big outcry from certain members of the community that it's a Muslim company and it should be boycotted in the country. So they definitely, there are other social and economic factors that are in play as well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, most of Southeast Asia, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, and Sri Lanka, Theravada Buddhism had really reached sort of the nadir of vitality in the 19th century. I mean, it was really anti-colonialist movements that helped construct a national identity on the basis of Buddhism. As soon as the new governments came into place, the government became very tied up with the with Buddhism and the Sangha, not necessarily by declaring a state religion, but it's certainly by requiring registration and passing exams and a reformation of the Sangha, which in some ways certainly brought revitalization and a better quality of monk, if you want. Mm-hmm. It's certainly forever then tied Buddhism to national identity there. And I think part of the one of the interesting dynamics is that certainly in Burma, the Bengali population was brought by the British and is obviously going to be disliked and distrusted. But the question is, why the violence now? Mm-hmm. And I think that seems to me fairly clearly strongly supported by the government in response to things like the Saffron Revolution and the boycotts of Burma, where mm-hmm. the standard of living has plummeted over the last 12 years or so. And it's very convenient that suddenly, after the Saffron Revolution, a new movement gets started, not based on the values of Buddhism, but Buddhism is a national identity. We have to purify our society of this stain of Muslims. You have to suspect that in the face of large-scale resistance to the government 2 years ago, and the Sangha being very conspicuous in that they've been completely co-opted by the government by making them this instrument of nationalist policy. It's really kind of a very skillfully done to take all attention away from how the government has really screwed things up now to how can we rid our society of this Muslim stain. Mm-hmm. It's really amazing.
Absolutely.
So both Sunil and Douglas referred to the Saffron Revolution. Do you all know what that is historically, or I could just give a brief?
What?
The Saffron Revolution, do you know about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
But that was where monks, actually, it's funny, because the monks were against the government and were self-immolating.
I don't know that there was so much self-immolation in Burma, that's been in Tibet, but what happened, there was this very oppressive government, Aung San Suu Kyi, who you mentioned, who was this wonderful figure standing under house arrest for many years. There was the revolution against that government that overthrew that government was led by monks who, very interesting, they would not accept alms from the government leaders and their family who considered themselves Buddhists, and in Theravada countries, you get merit from giving to monks. And for the monks not to accept alms from the families of the rulers was, this huge insult. It led to this there was violence there too, but it led to a change in the government led by the monks. So it's been a very tumultuous history. So Laurel, you were going to make some comments.
Yeah, I had a question. If I understood your methodology, you did a lot of interviews, one-on-one interviews. Did you talk to Muslims? And if so, what were they saying? What were they thinking?
So demographically speaking, I talked to 10 Buddhist and 10 Muslim leaders, prominent leaders. I chose with the help of local people and some agencies. Muslims, a lot of times they're scared. They don't necessarily want to talk to, they didn't want to talk to me a lot of times. Buddhists won't want to talk to me because they don't want to look as a bad person. Or like they don't want us to ask him questions in many ways. I was declined interview multiple times, or every time I would bring up Muslim-Buddhist conflict, the conversation would end. That would be the biggest in terms of Buddhist conversation. In terms of Muslim conversation, it would take me at least first half an hour, if not first full hour of interview, to build some kind of trust. In a sense, of what they divulge.
How did you present yourself as a scholar?
Mostly as a scholar, yes. Mostly as a scholar. It helped the fact that I was from Nepal, especially with Buddhist conversations, because I was seen as a person who came from the land of Buddha in many ways. It was seen favorably. And it helped me with Muslims because I looked like a Muslim. So it worked in some ways. When those things were putting me in some kind of risky situations, at the same time having conversation made it a little bit easier. And as a scholar, they welcome him a lot of times. So, yeah. And also to go back to Doug's comment in terms of Muslims coming with British. I mean, Muslims have been there for a while. They've been in Arakan state since 7th century, and they're known as now Arakan Muslims. And then there are Bengali Muslims who came later with British, and then there are Indian Muslims who migrate later. The problem is that the government is indiscriminately treating everybody the same way in a discriminated way. And the worst part of that treatment is all Rohingyas either is going to be, all Muslims, they're either going to be kicked out of the country, or they will be all be persecuted or killed, or they will just be stateless for a while, just live in refugee camps. And that's the worst situation. Those are the three worst outcomes of this situation. I don't see in a recent future they being brought back to the mainstream politics or society in time. So I think that's the worst part of the whole conflict, in a sense. Now they are all put into this one Rohingya state, where even to travel from, like, let's say north side of Chicago to south side of Chicago, that distance, you have to have a pass and go through government procedure. So you can't even travel. The aid is so bad that they don't have food, they don't have health insurance, all that. And a lot of them are fleeing to Thailand, around 100,000 this last year only. They flee to Thailand, and who's helping them to flee is military, and they're paying them a lot of money to help them flee because they're restricting their, putting their rule. So it's like this hypocritical double standard where they're implementing a rule and then they're taking them out by getting bribes and all that. So,
but sort of doctrinally, I think it's kind of interesting that you have to reach out to the Kalachakra Tantra to find support for the position. I mean, every other respect, Tantra would be anathema to those monks. So they can't find anything in the Pali Canon to support the position, so they have to reach out to a pretty unusual Tibetan text.
Yeah, I mean, Kalachakra is probably the one text where you can go and see a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment, if you interpret it that way. It's one place, it's a central place where you can go and find that.
Just briefly, the Kalachakra Tantra is one of the main things that His Holiness the Dalai Lama has taught in this country, and I think, as you say, it's a matter of interpretation. Mm-hmm. One way to interpret the passage that you were referring to, and I think, so I did the Kalachakra Tantra for, you know, it was like 8 days or something with his Holiness the Dalai Lama a good while ago, but I think another way of interpreting those barbarians is not as literally, you know, mm-hmm. some other minority, but as the aspects of ourselves that are the need to be purified or that are defiled. So, you know, in Tantra, these things are seen kind of symbolically. Mm-hmm. Just to say that.
But, yeah. Thank you.
It seems like all of human nature, but, you know, Buddhism are no less than Christians who led the Holocaust, or the Jewish fundamentalists who are doing a different type of Holocaust within Israel.
Mm-hmm. But the KKK that burns crosses.
Right.
Yeah. I was reading one of the books where they did this, and there was a quote that says, our religions are capable of violence, mm-hmm. but good religions are capable of not doing it. And in the sense that if you look at the history of all religious practice, structured religion, they were having instances of violence. It's about how we approach it. Now,
very troubling. Yeah. Very troubling.
Other comments, questions?
I think in Bhutan there's a similar situation with Buddhists being in power, and I think maybe the Hindu minority there that's so discriminated against.
Yeah, I think they're more into lineage kind of thing, and also the Nepalese are persecuted there, similar to Rohingyas are. And mm-hmm. I think Chicago has a decent number of Bhutanese and police refugees who come here.
Which kind? Bhutanese?
Bhutanese, yeah, who have lineage from Nepal, who migrated there from Nepal years ago.
Yeah,
in terms of your question about how this is relevant for us, in terms of practice, is very important. Organized religion, whatever the religious theology or doctrine, when it becomes institutionalized, has at times this kind of capacity for fundamentalism and dividing and saying, you know, they're no good and we're the, you know, they're the barbarians and, you know, mm-hmm. we're the righteous. So it's an important point for us in our practice to use Zazen, to use the Dharma that in our tradition, not in a way of separating us from others, but to see how it shows us connection and real tolerance. And, you know, we will chant, but beings are numberless, we've got to free them. That means all beings, so the mm-hmm. sense of inclusiveness. But it seems in the world today in so many ways, you know, we've talked here a little bit about racism in our country and the way African Americans are have been killed with impunity by police people, and there's so many problems in the world. And so, how do we offer awareness and the questioning that you were talking about too, to look at all of this, and how do we, in our own lives, express? Not just tolerance in the sense of tolerating others, but actually being interested in the differences. Mm-hmm. Instead of, you know, creating separation.
Yeah, somebody had mentioned in my last talk that it seems like this is all political and economic, and that the reason has nothing to do with it. But I think the reason has a big responsibility in terms of acknowledging it also has a good responsibility and good constructive capital in that sense to do a lot well with these kind of situations, to have conversations like this. I think it's important to be able to have this conversation in a spirit like this. So.
Yes, and I appreciate your bringing up this issue. Maybe it's fortunate that Buddhism is such a minority, not so powerful or wealthy religion in this country. So we have the perspective of looking at religions without feeling, you know, kind of privileged by them. But I don't know, other comments or questions or reflections or questions for Sunil as a resource about this?
It's just a reflection. It's interesting because I heard on public radio how many of the Muslims in France are now coming out and saying these people don't reflect us, mm-hmm. you know, and signs of men in Muslim attire, Muslim with people in Muslim attire carrying signs, "Je suis Jude," I'm a Jew, and in reaction to the killings at the delicatessen, and yet at the same time as the reaction within the Muslim community, both here and in Europe, saying we're tired of apologizing. Okay. And there's even a website for where Muslims could go and post saying, you know, I'm tired of apologizing all the time. And it's so divisive. It's so dividing us into and us and them, that is international in scope.
Yeah.
Another aspect of this, in this us and them and separation, is that certain groups then are used as scapegoats. And that's part of the reaction that is very dangerous to what happened in France, potentially, that we see even liberal commentators sort of claiming that all Muslims are or terrorists or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so part of our job, maybe, or part of our practice, in the realms that we engage with people and in conversation, can be to try and point out that we are connected, and not to get caught up in, you know, stigmatizing any minority, or, you know, and that all philosophies, as you were saying, even, you know, wonderful teachings, can be misused and made into a kind of fundamentalist excuse for scapegoating. So
yeah, in the beginning of this when the conflict started, the common sentiments of, like, for once the Buddhists are acting like Muslims. And it's in a sense that we have in many ways generalized religious intolerance and terrorism with Islam, like, globally. And it's kind of sad to see that happen. And it's a big problem. Any incident like Charlie Hebdo is that it's the black glass of it. And I think in every community, it's kind of had to work together in that.
Yes, sure.
You know, I didn't see the cartoon in the newspaper that started the whole, but it occurred to me that in this country, if someone did a cartoon about the Christ figure or a Christian figure, there'd be a huge uproar. And, you know, somehow there's a lesson here that we get too tied to our own belief system that, not the truth, maybe, you know, a little on the road, a little bit, but you have to sort of learn to lighten up about your own belief system, mm-hmm. and faith, and to sort of understand, blowing up the editorial office probably wasn't the best response, but I still think, if it was the Christ figure that was criticized, people would take a different view and be a little more, get at least the concept that the people were insulted here. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't. There's a lot of causes here to go around.
Yes, thank you. It's very complicated. There's the idea of free speech, which we cherish, but there's also the reality of hate speech, and the way fundamentalism can be misused. So, you know, in terms of our practice, when you were talking about that, I was thinking of Thich Nhat Hanh's first precept of his order of inner being, which is not to hold to any particular view. You know, the spirit is to listen to others and to not try and promote your view, to try and persuade others of your particular view. Right view in Buddhism is to be open to listen to other perspectives. So compassion has to do with empathy and listening to the suffering of others. So, you know, if the Muslims and the Burmese could actually listen to each other, the same with the Palestinians and the Israelis, and, you know, peace in Ireland, or to some extent has happened because of being able to listen, Protestants and Catholics. Peter Coyote, when he was here a couple months ago, and those talks are now up on our website, was talking about how as human beings we can be Mother Teresa and we can be Hitler, and we have to recognize that. And even in our, idealism of Buddhism or whatever, mm-hmm. and which shouldn't be romanticizing, as you said. Anyway, it's very complicated, and we should see this. So, yeah, thank you, Jerry, for your comments. It's time to stop. But if anybody has a last question or thought or reflection, anyone?
I think for me personally, the big task and part of my practice now in the morning is to dedicate my practice to Kanzeon, and part of that is I ask that that those who not only are victims of torture, but those who inflict torture, and not only those who are victims of war, but those who inflict war, mm-hmm. that they benefit from the merit of my practice. That they, it's hard for me. I hear this about the Buddhist priests and the kind of Buddhist monks, and yet at the same time, it's all over. And I think it behooves us. It behooves me. For me, as a practitioner, to have compassion for all people, and that may they all find in their own hearts to be open and compassionate to others. And that's not always easy, but that's something that we all have to do in our own practice.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we can, with that spirit, respond to harm that is being caused or inflicted by even Buddhist monks.
Yeah.
Thank you all. We'll close with the four Bodhisattva vows.
Thank you very much,
Sunil. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them.